AI Lab
AI Lab
Radio show about the European Artificial Intelligence Lab. The latest developments in artificial intelligence truly are astonishing. They will soon be advancing exponentially with the increasing scientific and economic power that is invested by research and industry. However, artificial intelligence and machine learning are difficult to understand, not only for the general society, and to be trusted, not least because of implicit biases. In February 2019, McKinsey published that, quote, "If Europe on average develops and diffuses AI according to its current assets and digital position relative to the world, it could add some 2.7 trillion euros or 20% to its combined economic output by 2030," unquote. But how can we ensure that our European education systems, our legal and ethical frameworks, in general, our society, is ready for its adoption by 2030? In light of this urge, the European Artificial Intelligence Lab focuses next to scientific, technological and economic aspects strongly on legal, cultural, educational and ethical dimensions of artificial intelligence. This allows a holistic model with considerations on human values and elementary questions on what AI should or should not do, as well as how and by whom AI systems are developed, deployed, used, and monitored. From the perspective of 13 major cultural operators in Europe and led by Ars Electronica, the European Artificial Intelligence Lab centers visions, expectations and fears that we associate with the conception of a future all-encompassing artificial intelligence. Partners of the European Artificial Intelligence Lab are Ars Electronica from Austria, Center for Promotion of Science from Serbia, Zaragoza City of Knowledge Foundation from Spain, Laboral Centro de Arte y Creación Industrial also from Spain, Kersnikova Institute, Kapelica Gallery from Slovenia, Science Gallery Dublin from Ireland, Onassis Stegi from Greece, The Culture Yard from Denmark, Gluon from Belgium, Hexagon Scene National Arts Sciences from France, SO Festival from Georgia, Le Lieu Unique from France, and VAG from Netherlands. While industries are pumping massive amounts of money into cutting-edge technologies to develop intelligent systems, mentioned cultural operators are connecting artists with research institutions and scientists to fill a gap in dealing with the social components and political questions arising from these enormous technological advances.
An extensive program of activities addressing different target groups at various experience levels was carried out and will be continued until the end of the project. By addressing AI and its societal impacts through exhibitions and conferences, which target art and general audiences, and at the same time fostering the knowledge on AI with educational and training activities, the AI Lab contributes to a critical and reflective society. In this broadcasting series, we will talk with five artists about the topic of AI and gender, or AI and bias. It is being increasingly acknowledged that AI systems are often biased. AI appears neutral, but it's made by humans, which means it internalizes all the same bias as we have, including gender and racial bias. There have been genuine instances which have raised questions about the fairness of decisions made by AI systems. One popular case study is Amazon's AI recruitment tool. Amazon had developed a tool to help with recruitment, which helped in screening of resumes. It was trained on 10 years' data of Amazon's internal recruitment decisions. Amazon later decided to remove the tool when it was discovered that the tool was more likely to pick men over women. Focusing on ethical dimensions and human-centric AI developments, we will discuss what kind of data is considered and how it is gathered for AI. How are artists dealing with AI and bias? We will also tackle questions such as how do AI systems get biased and how can we avoid it? How can we build new ways of establishing trustworthiness, transparency, and explicability of AI in interaction with citizens?
The European Artificial Intelligence Lab is co-funded by the Creative Europe Programme of the European Union.
In the second episode of this year's AI Lab radio show, we welcome Mimi Onoha. Mimi Onoha is a Nigerian-American artist and researcher whose work highlights the social relationships and power dynamics behind data collection. Her multimedia practice uses print, code, installation, and video to call attention to the ways in which those in the margins are differently abstracted, represented, and missed by socio-technical systems. In the following interview, Mimi gives insights into her recent works like The Future is Here or The Library of Missing Datasets. The Future is Here is a commission from 2019 which examines the process of dataset creation. The installation piece The Library of Missing Datasets is a physical repository of those things that have been excluded in a society where so much is collected. In an interview on YouTube, Mimi says that she is interested in the stories that are wrapped up within technology. Which stories bias our conception of how artificial intelligence works nowadays? What are the consequences of being forgotten in our modern, digitalized and mapped society? Mimi states that not everything can be represented in datasets. Why is that and who actually collects data? Hi Mimi Onoha, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks a lot for participating and welcome to the AI Lab Radio.
Thank you. It is really a pleasure to be here.
Can you please introduce yourself first for our listeners, please?
Absolutely. My name is Mimi Onoha. As you said, I'm an artist. A lot of my work is in this space of thinking about emerging technology and data collection, but really considering the ways in which it intersects with existing social realities and power dynamics that we've encountered in our world for a long time. And really thinking about the ways in which that new thing kind of comes up against that older thing and how they work well together or don't work well together, as it often is.
Yeah, that's right. Well, our show is about how and why AI systems get biased. And also in your work, you give proof that this bias oftentimes has good reason. Well, my first question maybe is how do AI systems get biased? And connected with that, maybe you can tell us, for example, more about your installation piece called The Library of Missing Datasets, which I found
Great.
Really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, in fact, I will answer that question starting from the back, from the second part, because that kind of gets at the first part. Mm-hmm. So the Library of Missing Datasets is an installation project that's also a bit of a research project that I have been carrying out for years now. I want to say since 2016, although in different iterations. And the kind of art installation version of that is this filing cabinet that's been treated in different ways, but it essentially acts as a repository of data that we do not collect. And part of the piece is just including those different, the data sets that we don't have, things that we're not collecting in it. But a much larger part of the piece is talking about this, these patterns of absence. So the different reasons why it is that we don't have all the data in the world or why it is that we're not collecting everything. And those patterns are, I call those patterns of absence because really there is sort of a rhythm to them and there are kind of set reasons for why it is that we can't collect everything. Some of it has to do with it's difficult to measure. Some things just elude being able to fit into data. Some things you know, it's sometimes it's some of the missing data sets are about this idea of how there can be a burden to actually collect data, and that burden of collecting it can be perceived as more difficult or not worth what it would be to actually have the data set at the end of the day. There are all these different reasons, but really part of what the piece is talking about is that it takes a lot. It takes a lot. There's a process that happens in order to take the world and turn it into a data set. And that process necessarily, just because of the way it is and because of the nature of the world and the nature of data, not everything will be included in it. And so this is what gets it really, the first part of the question you were asking about bias, really. A huge thing starts by looking at data. And for me, I've always found looking at data collection and that moment of trying to collect data is really, really important because it gets at these issues. Whatever you can't collect is then going to end up being this sort of blank spot if you're ever trying to design a system that is based on that. Mm-hmm. So I like using the Library of Missing Data Sets as a way to think about that from a lot of different perspectives, where it is foregrounding the absence and then also making clear that that absence is very much a part of the process of collection, and also influenced by a variety of different factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you just said, considering the process of collecting data, not everything can be represented in data sets. And what comes to my mind right now is who collects actually data? And I'm thinking also of your work, The Future is Here, one of your most recent commissions.
Yes. Well, absolutely. I love this question. I'm so glad you asked it. The question of who collects data, because I think that often that is not a question that comes up. Just attaching the who, often people are like, well, what is the data? Like, where is it? How do I get it? And it's so rare that someone is like, but who is doing this? And the way that I often think about this is actually more in alignment with an older piece that I made, that I wrote. What was it called? It's called The Point of Collection. And part of what I was saying in that piece is that it was, like I said, it was an article. And part of what I was saying in that is that actually there is always a relationship that's at the heart of data collection. And it is this relationship that is between the group or people or person who wants to collect something and then the group or people or entity or whatever it is that is actually being collected. So you have those two things. So you might have the state, which wants to know information about birth rates. So then you've got the state, the people within that agency, that mission that is like, oh, we need to have this and the reasons for that. But then you've got the people, the citizens who will make up that data. Or you'll have like the criminal justice system, and yet it'll be about how people cycle in and out of prison. And there's the group that wants to have that information. And then there's the group that actually is doing the actual cycling in and out. And I think this is a simplification. Usually it's kind of, there are multiple groups on either side, and especially groups who want to have that versus the groups that make it up. And I'm speaking mostly about civic and social data now, but usually it's more than one group really involved. But even still, what I really like about thinking about that relationship is that then you can think about whose incentives are aligned. So often, it's very rare that you have a situation where the people who are collecting something are also the people who make up that data set. And in those situations, you don't tend to have any issues. Mm-hmm. But when you have a situation where the people who make up some kind of data set are not the same as the people who want to collect it, mm-hmm. well, that can often be when you have these problems arise.
Mm-hmm. And considering your work, The Future is Here, you give a very interesting visual examples where you see the places where actually data is collected, and those are places like it's very peculiar, like to see The Future is Here in a very common living room and in a very common workplace you see every day, but. And at the same time, ad messages tell you, well, it's super awesome and and shiny and fancy and stuff. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. I mean, I'm biased. I made the piece. But I agree with everything you said. I think that is something I found so interesting about it, was this dissonance. That piece is talking about the future is here, and it's playing on that idea of the future is physically in the places, because what's represented are the places where workers, mostly from the global south, are doing this annotating and tagging and labeling of huge machine learning data sets. And so this idea of the future is actually in those places, because if not for those places, then we wouldn't be able to have any of this gleaming technology that we think about, that we, especially people who are mostly in like the US and in Europe, are, that we think about a lot. But also this like idea of the future as this vision, this like mythical thing, and that story behind what a future looks like.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, actually it feels kind of similar to the past in some ways.
Well, talking about relations and dissonance, in an interview you said that you're interested in the stories that are wrapped up within technology. And can you also give further examples? Which stories bias our conception of how technology, and especially AI, works nowadays?
Absolutely. I think that piece, The Future Is Here, so good. Part of the reason I made it was this exact question that you're asking, which is that I was just so interested in the story that I hear about AI. And I am in a lot of spaces where I'm teaching or doing workshops around machine learning systems, either like in a way where I'm working with undergraduate students or with just kind of community members in libraries, doing all sorts of different things. And what often comes up is this idea that people have of what AI means, you know, and part of it I think is even in the name. Artificial intelligence sounds so much sexier than it could have been called anything. You know, machine learning, all these names, they do a lot of work and they make it sound like, they make these systems sound like much more complicated and like sexy than they are, I think.
Yeah,
and so that idea, I found that so many of the people in these workshops, so many people I talked to would immediately think, when they thought about things like AI systems, they would think immediately about Skynet and Terminator and these like completely robotic, autonomous, super smart, super sophisticated system. And because they were thinking of that, their questions would then be, can we protect ourselves? Is this going to take over the world? What are we going to do? You know, and that narrative, that image, very much created by Hollywood science fiction, was doing so much work and actually limiting or creating the bounds of how people could think about it. And so with a piece like The Future Is Here, part of what I wanted to show was, wait, hold on. Like, here's the reality. This is really what's happening, is that actually there are loads of laborers who are paid very small amounts of money to do the training work for these systems. And that is what has to happen before we can get to any stage of talking about strong AI versus weak AI versus all of these other things. In order to really have the systems that we are thinking about, you have to have this part. And that, like, that story, I think, trying to just poke a little bit at that, I think is really powerful, because then it changes the questions that you ask and it changes your concerns and it changes the way that you think about it in the first place. And also, I think that's extra, just one point I'll make is just that that's extra important, because particularly because that pattern of resources from the global south being used to further, you know, a world that's more comfortable or quote unquote sophisticated for places like the US and Europe is, as I've said, it's so traditional. It's something that always happens. And so I think the interesting thing with AI and machine, really, when we say AI, we're just talking about machine learning systems nowadays. Really, that interesting thing is the way in which it is presented as so, so novel and so unique. And it is, and also is not at the same time.
Totally, because the work of people in the global south, for example, is then totally forgotten in that sense. And well, what do you think? What are the consequences of being forgotten in this modern digitalized and mapped society?
That is also a really good question. And I think the thing about a question like that is that you, for me, in order to answer it, I have to be more specific, where I have to think, what are the consequences for which group by being forgotten by which group?
Maybe, you know? To more specify the question, maybe what is it for you? Maybe you are a Black woman living in the US and working in the United States. What is it for you? Because also your work, The Library of Missing Datasets, is also, I think, the latest piece of it looks at the life and the situation of Black people in the US.
Absolutely. The most recent version of that piece is really focused specifically on data sets that have to do with Blackness in the US or just racial justice in general, or I should say really the data sets that are missing are about just racial realities, really. And part of the reason I wanted to do that was because of this same relationship I was talking about before. What I noticed so much is that in the US, there's this huge trend of lots of people sort of reporting on and collecting data around data sets that have to do with Blackness. But still, there's this strange divide where the people who are represented in those data sets still actually don't have access to it or don't have a say over how the things are talked about. And so it becomes this kind of talking over. And I was in that work kind of thinking about that as another form of exploitation in a way. Mm-hmm. But I think this question you ask is really good because there's so many different levels to it as well. So there is that aspect of it, of who gets thinking, for me, really thinking about the ways in which, and you can see this across so many data sets, the issues, particularly for Black women, are kind of either minimized or not really, or are talked about without us sort of being at the center of them. Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions to that. But then there's this also another side of this, which is that sometimes the issue is not so much being forgotten, but really being overrepresented. Mm-hmm. And an example I can think about with this is actually around automated job systems. A couple years ago, lots of researchers here were talking about automated job systems where people would have to upload their resumes or their CVs. And rather than having it looked at by a person, they would be looked at by algorithms that would scan it for certain keywords, among other things, before deciding who got to go to the next round. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, loads of people who were applying for jobs were eliminated without their application even being seen by a person, no matter how strong of a candidate they would have been. So I am, you know, I'm Nigerian, I'm a Black woman, I live in the US, I'm also an artist, and I apply to work opportunities too. And realistically, none of the things that I apply to use those systems. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the researchers who are thinking about this, I would bet money that the majority of them did not get their jobs through applying through a similar system. And so in that case, the ones who are being forgotten are the people who actually have an advantage. We are like less surveilled. We are less subject to some of those systems. And so the question, then it's like, well, actually being overrepresented or over-surveilled or over-collected or like over-subject to these automated systems can also be a problem. And so I think I say this just to say that there are all these different levels of it. And really, it's not always so much just being like forgotten or represented, but really the ways in which you are and who is subject to it and how, what does that look like? Those become the questions, and I think are kind of complicated to think about, but really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, important.
Totally. Yeah, you're underrepresented and overrepresented at the same time. That's really interesting. Do you see some reactions to your pieces of work from maybe politicians or so? Or is there, how can art or your pieces of art affect the society or the political society?
That is also a good question and a really difficult question. I think in some ways it is, I've been lucky in some ways because some of the things I'm talking about are technical in nature. And I have just been lucky enough to have academics kind of quote some artworks or like bring them up or have them show up in some books or in articles. And that is just, the only reason I say that's lucky is because I can directly see the impact. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, most of the time, part of the thing that's difficult and I think important about working as an artist is you don't see the impact always of the work that you do. You don't see how it changes things. It's hard. And in fact, I think it's kind of crucial to the work I make too. I'm always talking about how things can't be represented in data sets. Like the most important work I think for in my art practice is this shifting the way that people look at the world and shifting the way that they think about things, the way that issues are framed and the way that they see, really the way that they see or don't see something like this. Like often I'm talking about how just historic, you know, colonialism and racism, these things are imbued in technology, of course. And being able to expand people to see that so that it's not just when they're like, oh, because it can't see your face, but really to be like, no, even in the production of this very thing or the way that we decide what gets value, we see those same things. But it's hard because you don't always, as an artist, you don't always get a direct one-to-one. You know, you can't always be like, here's the impact.
Yeah.
But what I will totally say is that it's nice. Sometimes this is why I like doing work that sometimes where I'm clear who the audience is for or what it's speaking to, because it makes it for me a bit simpler, where I'm like, I know this is meant to push against this particular narrative. And so the people I'm targeting are people who are interested in that. But sometimes, you know, not all work is like that. Sometimes the work is like, we're just trying to create something different.
Sometimes the impact comes around the corner and it surprises you maybe from time to time, right?
Yeah. And then you find out about it 5 years down the line. Yeah. And someone's like, yeah, that piece, like that thing you said, or that video you made really changed how I did this. And it turns out I work at Facebook. That's never happened to me, but it'd be great. That could happen.
Yeah. Well, one of the last questions, maybe how do current events like the Black Lives Matter movement or the Corona pandemic affect you as an artist and a researcher right now? And maybe also the question, what are you currently working on?
Yeah. I mean, also a good and difficult question. Oh my goodness. COVID has been really serious, you know? Yeah. So on a practical level, I think like a lot of people, I lost a lot of opportunities and residencies and exhibitions and had things canceled, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I will say, you know, in relation, there has been this moment of, in the US and I think globally in different ways, there's been this moment of like racial reckoning, a lot of it catalyzed by Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter movement, and also police brutality just in general. And that has allowed people to kind of think more widely about just issues of racism that have affected the world and structural racism in many ways. Mm-hmm. And for me, I guess what is interesting is that all of these crises have really exacerbated, they've made it easier to see some of the things that I feel like I've been thinking and talking about and working around for a while. So for instance, I've been working on this large project that's really about the potential in and also impossibility of creating data about these layers of violence that have colored the US's history, which have been leveled against indigenous people and Black folks and Puerto Ricans and certain immigrants and all other people who just didn't fit the country's idea of what humanity was or could be. And so work like that I had been working on before this moment and we'll be working on after. But I think that the way the work has shifted, because now it feels like there's a different level of, I don't even want to say understanding, but mm-hmm. level of awareness. And so that allows me to be able to do a bit more, you know, than before, which I think is good. But then I'm also been working on lots of smaller pieces that are about thinking about narratives of technology and nature and the kind of arbitrary divides between those, with West Africa as a backdrop. I'm Nigerian, so thinking about that. And again, in some ways, COVID has brought up these issues of movement and like borders and land and who has space and who doesn't. All of a sudden, they seem ever more relevant. They always have been. But it feels like what it reminds me of is I have spent a lot of time doing work around data and algorithms, and there was a shift. When I first started, a lot of the work was just being like, look, this matters. And now people are like, of course it does. And that means that we can have a different conversation. And I think that similarly, mm-hmm. I hope that it's the same thing with some of these topics I've been working on now. However, I will say this, I still think that even with all of the movements that have happened, that there's still worldwide is not really, there hasn't been a deep enough kind of understanding mm-hmm. of the ways in which anti-Blackness fuels so much of the world and has fueled it. And so I guess the question will be what happens in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I hope to be able to just keep doing that, even though the work might be digital. you know, it might not be in person, might not be an installation, but the work continues regardless.
So it's a shift in the conversation and in the level how we talk about that issue, to sum it up. But you continue with your work. Thanks for being on our show. And yeah, you're welcome anytime at the AI Lab Radio.
Great. Don't invite me. I'll come. Just wait.
Thanks a lot, Mimi.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
For more information about Mimi Onoha, visit her website, mimionoha.com. Maybe that was too fast for you. It's mimionouha.com. And for further informations about the AI Lab radio show, please visit fro.at. The next episode of the AI Lab radio show will be about the London-based digital filmmaker and storyteller Karen Palmer.